if you have any questions or something that you wanted to share before, also something about the text.
Well, it was lovely to read because it was good print and it had a story. So those were quite practical things that made it very good.
We were saying it was a good yarn as well, weren't we?
Yeah. Yeah. Really good story. It's very interesting what you said about the various literary sort of traditions, you know, how the goodies were all good and the baddies were very, very bad.
Yeah.
It's quite simplistic.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not subtle. You can tell what side he's on.
Blonde.
Sorry?
Short and blonde is one conspiracy. And yet, Giuliano was...
This is a very good point. The physical description of the conspirators, and it's interesting. It's a very good point because some scholars highlighted that also the structure of the text is somehow symmetrical. For this reason, so we start with the description of the conspirators, then we have the narrative of the conspiracy, and then we have the narrative of the revenge and the reprisal, which is somehow that mirrors the narrative of the conspiracy, and the portrayal, the eulogy, the commemoration of Giuliano, which mirrors this the opposite of the description of the plotters.
And it's clear that what you said of Poliziano being a witness, it's very detailed.
It's very detailed.
Then, first of all, laid his hand on Lorenzo's left shoulder, aiming a dagger
at
his throat.
Yeah. It's very visual. It's very detailed.
Film of this.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's why, although this is, as we said, a very propagandistic account with a very the pro-Medici perspective, but it was adopted as an important source also by 16th century historians, in particular also by Machiavelli in his Storie Fiorentine, when in the final chapter where he narrates the history of the conspiracy, because is a reliable source from the perspective of the narration of the events. And we have also to think that in general historiography in this century, although it's often quite propagandistic, but the principle of what they call the veritas, so truthfulness, which they recovered from the classical tradition and from the theory of history in the classical tradition. But veritas was an important principle. They tried to adapt it, but we never find something that is like a fake news, something that is a lie, that never happened. It's the perspective from which they narrate the story that is very propagandistic, but not the events. Maybe some anecdotes. I don't know if you have noticed that, especially in the descriptions of the conspirators, we have some anecdotal. For example, at the very beginning, Jacopo Pazzi is described as a gambler, attitude, his behavior when he gambles. So there are some.
Lack of stability.
Yeah, it's a very good point because this is a recurring feature associated with the conspirators, and in this case it is also emphasized by this example that it is by the description of his actual behavior.
he's stable, he's and also his physical appearance is the movement of the eyes, he's never stable with his head, so
the mania for spending.
Yeah, some very nice turns of phrase, actually. And I wonder whether some of them is some of them are slightly deliberately sarcastic. I'm looking at the description of Jacob, the third Jacob, son of Poggio.
What page?
Third page.
So 173.
And that big paragraph in the middle.
Ah, the third Jacopo too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, his outstanding gift was for speaking ill of people. That's quite funny. Did he mean it to be funny? Was it really?
Okay. Was the something this was for speaking ill of people?
And calling it a gift.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that... I don't remember exactly. I should have printed it. I can check on my laptop. But no, because of course the translation can be... Yes. But... but this is also in the Latin, of course. And I have to say that Poliziano has a very realistic style, especially in this case. It's a very sophisticated style because it seems realistic and simple, maybe in the translation, because the Latin is quite simple, it's quite difficult, but actually is a very accurate work with words, and some of them are recovered from classical authors, so all elements of the each element in the description is very carefully chosen, so probably sometimes it wants to be like sarcastic, we can say, like here, and from this point of view, it's interesting that he also uses comic sources from the classical tradition. So, for example, Terence. Terenzius in Italian, I don't know, sometimes I don't remember the English, Terence. And Plautus, no? The other comedian. Yeah. So, so I think that you are right. This is, Poliziano did this on purpose, probably also in this sentence, because in other sections, for example, at the end, close to the end, we have this description of the disinterring of the corpse of Jacopo Pazzi, this very, very young man, these boys, Florentine boys, who carry his body, and they make a fun of him. Mm-hmm. And in this section, for example, Poliziano directly recovers some expressions from these classical comic works. So you're right. He made it on purpose to emphasize in some sections this comic element, sarcastic elements, while maybe in other sections we can find a different style. I don't know what you think. Maybe if we think about the in particular, I think that the most tragic part, and also somehow the core of the whole work, is the assassination of Giuliano, which is if you can help me, 75. Thank you. I should have shown you also the Latin, maybe with the classical sources in Latin. But here we have it's the penultimate paragraph.
So, okay, when the priest had taken the wine, etc., then the following sentence, their leader, the leader of the conspirators, Bandini, took his sword and ran it through the young man's breast. Mm-hmm. Giuliano, though fatally wounded, retreated a few steps. The others followed. He lost consciousness and fell to the ground. Also, this, like, very... like, we have kind of juxtapositions of segments.
Yeah.
And as he lay there, Francesco struck him repeatedly with his dagger. Thus they killed the noble youth. So in this part, Poliziano uses some expressions drawn from, in this case, classical poetry. Mm-hmm. So Virgil, so the most important epic works, Virgil. From Virgil he recorders the very last sentence. The servant in attendance of Giuliano, fainting with terror, rushed shamefully into hiding. Of course, in the classical source we have a different context, but the words and this particular element is we can recognize this from the exact words that he uses, mm-hmm. are taken from Virgil, and also this expression which describes Giuliano, noble youth, mm-hmm. actually in Latin is pium juvenem, so the young the Pio is just is very noble, religious, very noble in moral, from a moral perspective. This expression is taken from Ovid. So we have Ovid, Virgil, Apuleius also in another, but just in a few lines. So you can see that it's very sophisticated, and maybe he wants to convey a different message, to create a different perspective in the sentences, in different sections of the text.
One thing that surprised me, there's nothing about them being the murder taking place in a church, because there's no, is there any sense in which that is considered a more heinous crime than killing them outside? And if so, why did they do it? Because in a sense they would get more severely punished, perhaps. Yeah. And yeah, it's also that sense that if you murder somebody in the church, they go straight to heaven. And like when Hamlet looks at Claudius praying and decides not to kill him, because he feels that if he kills him now, he'll go straight to heaven because he's praying.
Yeah, there are historical reasons for this. So the conspirators tried to put in action their plan also at least two times before this day. And they plotted this since at least 1477, so the year before. But they wanted to kill Giuliano and Lorenzo, so the both brothers, the two brothers together, because their plan was that if one of them remained alive, it was, everything was pointless. So after they missed the last chance to do this, because when they firstly tried, Giuliano didn't show up, so they couldn't do this. In the end, they decided that this was the last chance, because also this conspiracy had been planned for too long, so they were scared to be discovered. And so, but you are right, because one of the plotters and a condottiero who was involved in the plan, Giovanni Battista Montesecco, he at the beginning he had the role of the killer of Lorenzo, and he gave up. He said, I cannot do this, especially because the plan was now, I mean, at that point it was in the church. This is one of the reasons why he gave up. So they had to find very quickly someone else. This is also why someone says that they weren't able to kill Lorenzo. But yeah, you're right. After this very sacrilegious murder in the church, there was also since there was also a very harsh revenge, there was another conflict with the Pope. So the Pope accused Lorenzo of killing some religious figures who were involved in the church, and he excommunicated Lorenzo and also somehow the city of Florence. So this religious dimension is very present, and it's something that makes this event maybe more also very famous from, because it's we have seen that other conspiracies were somehow, I mean, rotated around the church or the Pope. There was a conspiracy against the Pope, but this is a conspiracy that was carried out in a church. So it's a
excommunicated Lorenzo and somehow Florence as well, you said. Did that cancel out Lorenzo's cultural propaganda?
It's a very good point. Actually, he tried to, but he didn't. The reaction of Lorenzo, also from this character perspective, was very well planned, and we can say all pervading and all embracing. So also Sixtus the Fourth, for example, published the documents, the bulls, through which he excommunicated Lorenzo. So he also uses the new means of the printing press. But Lorenzo was able also to... he recruited also some jurists. So, like, very expert also in the juridical field to try to confute the Pope's accusations. And so, because the Popes mainly accused him of killing some members of the church who were involved in the conspiracy. And because you have seen that Poliziano describes this very, in a very realistic way, there was a very, the revenge was very violent and brutal. And Lorenzo also, like he said, that he took into custody the nephew of the Pope, who was a cardinal, and who was present in Florence in that in those days. So here we have two versions. Lorenzo said that he tried to save him from the revenge, but actually wanted to use it as a kind of leverage to with the Pope. And the Pope accused him of capturing, imprisoning a member of the church. And here we have jurists involved because it's a juridical issue. The jurisdiction of the members of the church is of the Pope, of the political power of Lorenzo. So who has the right to punish a member of the church? And also the problem is that Lorenzo didn't do a proper trial to find out if these men were actually responsible and involved in the church. They just were present there, and the revenge was brutal. Yeah, but this this conflict. So this conflict too was military, actually, because after the conspiracy there was a war, which lasted until 1480. So we have a war between Florence and Lorenzo, and their allies Milan and Venice, but mainly Florence, and the Pope and the King of Naples. And so military conflict, but also juridical conflict, or this juridical and religious. And sometimes I say cultural and literary conflict, because we have many literary works and artistic works. I just showed you these medals, but there are other, for example, Botticelli, the very famous painter of the Primavera, etc. He was Lorenzo. Like asked him to paint on the walls of the palace of Florence, of the palace of the Signori, the public palace, the images of the conspirators executed. So very, you can see it's very I don't know. It's also through the vehicle of visual culture. So also this is probably more effective somehow than just words. Everyone could see the these evil men who were justly punished, fairly punished for their crimes. We don't have these images, these frescoes anymore in Florence, because when the Medici were banished in 1494, stories is like soap opera. When the Medici were banished, we have a period of republic, and so this. These images were considered like a symbol of the Medici power, and they were removed. But we have, for example, a portrait of Giuliano, again painted by Botticelli as a commemoration of Giuliano after the conspiracy. You can find it all. We have different versions, actually, of this. I have this on another PowerPoint, actually, but I should. And we have, and also literary works, and in general text, narratives of the conspiracy. So, this is a.
Actually, Lorenzo seemed to pull himself together very quickly. He took control very quickly, which shows you the sort of person he was, because obviously he got a good political brain, and he recovered quite quickly from quite a traumatic experience. His brother had been killed in front of him.
Yeah.
He knew what he got to do.
Yeah, this is true. When I had to study this work, I was interested to read the first letter that that Lorenzo sent to Milan, where the Dukes of Milan were his allies, the very day of the conspiracy. And he says just two lines, just saying, my brother was killed, they are trying to kill everyone, we are in it's dramatic, it's very tragic, and if you think of these documents as evidence of the life of these people, is more, if you like, you feel closer to them, and when you have the chance to see this kind of original documents, is also somehow more you feel like closer to this. But yeah, but you are totally right, and in the end it was he was so able, so skilled in dealing with this difficult situation, that in the end, after the war in 1480, I told you that there was this war, it was Lorenzo who was able to put this war to an end, because he again, and we have these narratives of this episode, so we don't know if it's probably, it seems so a very good ruler, because we read that. But because I wanted to show you also this description we have in the commentary, where Lorenzo is described as a prince, that everyone comes to his house to see him and to celebrate him. But yeah, in 1480, Florence was in a very difficult situation after more than 1 year of war. It was like it was very hard for everyone, also for the common people, and so he decided to go to Naples to try to negotiate, to find an agreement, peace agreement with the King of Naples. Now we know, historians say that this travel was carefully planned, that it wasn't just, but in the original story, in some original sources, this was depicted as a very brave a diplomatic action, that he risked his life to do this. And also Machiavelli describes Machiavelli like quote the speech that Lorenzo delivered in front of the Florentine citizens before leaving, saying, my life is your hand. I do what you want. I go there because I want to save the city. I am the city. So he underlines with this, I want to save you, but I survived thanks to you. So he also emphasized this perspective. And in the end, he was able to sign this peace agreement. And this was considered a very a very important turning point, and a diplomatic mission that showed everyone the diplomatic Lorenzo's diplomatic skills. So we say in Italian that they also Guicciardini described it as the ago della bilancia. So he was able to maintain the balance after that between all the Italian states. So it was very. And after this peace agreement, he also, the Pope had to end the war. So you are right.
How did he get the title the Magnificent?
This is a very good point. I should know this. I don't know when it he got it, but the it's a kind of virtue now of magnificence, magnificenza. It was something that was gradually associated to him more and more frequently. For example, also in the commentarium, sometimes you can find the description. For example, when Lorenzo organized the kind of lunch, like a banquet with the, so there is a description of the carpets, of the, so all the artistic elements of the house. And it's called the Magnificent also because we can say that he invested a lot of money
in art, culture. So this was a distinctive element of his rule, and also Cosimo before him, his grandfather. He understood that this could be a key to show that they were just private citizens, but they care a lot of the city, and they could provide. They could make Florence flourish, and that's why this idea of magnificence gradually it became like the main virtue associated with Lorenzo.
So the big thing is there's more of the politics going on now. Hadn't it already gone on? It's just that there's records now, and that's what makes it. There must be people who behave like this even before Lorenzo, but there's no record of it. And that's why this is so important.
There's no record of.
Well,
you mean
you can see the means of what he's using this for.
Mm.
But I was thinking people were always like that, weren't they?
Yeah,
but the whole point
is.
Yes, and then I was wanting to say, have people learn from that? Have they learned just to do it?
Yeah, this is interesting because we can find some the history is like you mean
it comes and goes.
In some ages, in some periods, maybe we find some particular features or historical processes, and then we have a change, but after a while it comes again. What is interesting is that here in this period we have this kind of new rulers, as I said, were able to create a kind of new system, also kind of new system of power, also because of there was a kind of change from the perspective of the Middle Ages. So this is somehow different because in the Middle Ages, political power, just to make it very simple, but it was mainly considered as bestowed by God through like the main source of legitimacy was was still the church, who was more a kind of universal institution, also because it was connected with the empire. There was still the empire of the legacy of the Roman Empire, and then with Charlemagne, the Sacro Roman Empire. But after that, we have there is a turning point from a political perspective, but also from a cultural perspective, because the main element that now is considered fundamental to be so. Legitimacy is the virtue of the ruler. So the human sphere is more important somehow, also because the church we have seen is more like one of the other states. Of course the religion is always a fundamental issue in the lives of men, but we have this idea of the man of the Renaissance, so the man who is able to build his own world. And so that's why in
in historical texts also, but also in political treatises, we have the description of the perfect ruler, the perfect prince, in what are called these mirrors for princes, as I said. So the ruler sees his image in the mirror, and the mirror reflects the image of the ideal ruler, so how the ruler should be. And in this text we have a description of the text of the perfect ruler, which is mainly a kind of list of virtues. What are the virtues? And they are quite, it's a complex system. It's not just something that justice, clemency. And this is part of my research now, to see, for example, what is the relationship between these theoretical works, these political theory, so the description of the perfect ruler, and the historical sources, so how the actual ruler are described. They should be merciful, but they are merciful actually. Why? How they are portrayed in different texts. So this is another perspective. But yeah, this is, so it's we have always a continuity, but some historical phases are considered like turning point in the... Okay.
Fascinating.
Yeah. I think that we should hand here also because I think that Jane has to give you something for the last session in the next week.
Yeah.
It's the last one because it's the last one.
Yeah.
Yeah.